We're going to begin with Norm Yan, who is from York University, one of our invited guests from out of town. He has worked for the Ontario Ministry of the Environment for 25 years, and then he joined York University in 2000. He splits his time now between the Dorset Environmental Centre, Science Centre of the Ontario Ministry of the Environment, and York University. He has co-authored over 200 publications on a variety of topics. He has received several provincial and federal awards in recognition of his work, culminating with his induction last year into the Royal Society of Canada. His research has sought to understand the impacts of multiple environmental stressors on Canadian lakes, particularly on zooplankton communities, and he will draw upon much of this research and his policy experience. It's a valuable and unusual mix in his talk, which focuses on the future of northern lakes. Norm Yan.
It shows that we're used to other people launching our talks for us. Where is it, Tunnel?
Oh, sorry. I should have set up. Oops, it's yours. There you go.
Oh, heavens. I'm still a Luddite. I use older technology. I'll get down there to watch that. Okay, thanks everyone for coming so early in the day. A pleasure to see a few familiar faces. I'm going to the okay. Okay. It's a pleasure to be here and to lead off the day. We have 3 million lakes in Canada. I can't talk about all of them, but I'll focus on a bunch that are at the southern edge of the Canadian Shield, but I think reflect a bunch of the problems that we are going to talk about today. And it's timely to have a session with this theme for a couple of reasons. One reason is that stressors that we thought of as emerging and rare, we're now beginning to see happen more often. This is the second anniversary of the horrible triple catastrophe in Japan, and paleogeological work and archaeological work since this horrible event have indicated that these things actually happen with a reasonable frequency, but every couple hundred years. So they're going to happen again. They've happened before. Other threats that are much more common, like hurricanes, appear to have worsened. For example, the Hurricane Sandy from last year that led to North America's first climate refugees. And then today we're going to hear about several thresholds that we're about to bridge, I believe. We'll hear about phosphorus, the end of cheap phosphorus, I suspect. We're certainly going to hear something about capture fisheries, I believe, in the next talk. And then water issues themselves are becoming enormous issues, especially in Western Canada. So key environmental thresholds are approaching. Rare events are becoming more often. Other catastrophes appear to be worsening. And in Canada, anyway, here's the policy part that Tony mentioned. There are changes in many federal acts that appear to reduce protection and oversight. There's some very high-profile things happening that affect our ability to do environmental science well in Canada, for example, the impending closure of ELA. Still not absolutely certain. And much in the news is the muzzling of environmental scientists and the declaring surplus of many others. So what I'm hoping to do in the next half hour or so is reflect on this status of affairs when things seem to be getting worse environmentally at a time when we're not watching, at least federally. So very quickly, I'll introduce you to the data I'm going to use. I'll prove that multiple stressors are on the rise for northern lakes. I'll prove that these stressors interact. I'll consider what changes might be occurring, which is the mission Tony gave the speakers today, over the next couple of decades, and then ask if we're ready as a society, and then end, hopefully, on a note of optimism. So I'll first introduce you to the data. Tony, when he invites me, knows I'm going to talk about plankton. Why am I doing that? Because we'd be hungry, given that plankton sustain many marine food chains. We'd be dim-witted, because about 15% of the lipids in our brain actually comes from plankton. We'd likely be dead, because every second breath we take is a gift of plankton. and if that isn't enough reason, you know, for every 1% of water that's cleaned by things drifting out outflows, that water's been processed typically 100 times by plankton. So they keep our lakes clean, they fuel our food webs, and they're very sensitive indicators of environmental change. Just to introduce, how many people in the audience have dragged a plankton net through the water? Okay, this is good. So just to introduce the others who haven't had the great good fortune of working with plankton to what a few of these things look like, there are big things that are maybe up to an inch long. So we have... No, this isn't working. I still use XP. Yeah, how do I get down there? That it there? Up there?
Current slide.
Like the phantom midge or the glass worm in the talk, a predator, that's the Chiabris. The amazingly photogenic Leptodora, that's the picture that won one of the Nikon Small World. That's its amazing eye. Another native here is Mysis, the opossum shrimp, that's been a bit pushed down south by the glaciers 10,000 years ago. Those are all native, but there's invaders too, like Crespid acusta, the jellyfish that doesn't cause any problems, or Bithotrepes, the spiny water flea that does. And they're all predators, and they eat these things, the cladocera like Daphnia, that's a model species in ecotoxicology, or copepods, like the limnocalanus shown there. And these copepods are among the world's most important metazoa because they're dominant animals in the ocean. The data I'm going to talk about come from that little blow up there, the eastern side of Georgian Bay. This watershed, commonly called Muskoka, that has about 1,700 lakes, it's about 12% water. And, of course, much of Canada, about a third of Canada, actually looks like this. So I'm hoping what I'll say today applies at least to central and eastern, northeastern Canada. I'll be making reference, I'm going to mention Palmer, Michelle Palmer, a few times, because she's just finished her PhD with me, and I'm going to be quoting a bunch of her work. I live near the biggest lake here, and I work at Dorset, where that little arrow was, every day. And our lakes look like this. Many of you that have gone up to the Laurentians or in any place in eastern Canada that has shield lakes, you know they look like this. They look terrific, but this lake has lost crayfish. It's lost five Daphnia species. The fish are in trouble. So we have these lakes that look beautiful from the outside, but there are stressors that cause multiple problems for them. So remember the name Plastic Lake. I'll be coming back to it a few times. So I want to start by proving to you that our environments for northern lakes are changing in many ways, physically, chemically, and ecologically. So let's start with physics. I'm borrowing a couple slides here from Hawasha Yao, who's a hydrologist at our lab, and the upper curve there is the one that's going up is the ice on date in the fall. So at least in our lakes, this is an example of Dickey Lake, they're not opening up earlier in the spring, but they're freezing later in the fall. And that leads to longer ice-free seasons and shorter ice cover seasons. That's the lower curve. So why are they freezing later in the fall? Well, if you look at the October, November, December meteorological data and look at that upper curve, the air temperature in the last 35 years has gone from below zero to above zero in the fall. And more interestingly, the wind speeds have fallen. And the wind speeds have fallen because forests are rising, largely, at least in the area. And so the result of that is that there's less cooling of the water. So that decline in wind speed is little recognized, but is enormously important for the physics of lakes. The result of that is that, on average, when we look at our long-term study lakes that we sample every 2 weeks or every month, and this is seven of them that stratify in one of Michelle's papers from her PhD, the lakes are warming, particularly in the fall. So about almost a degree a decade in surface waters. And so for a whole volume-weighted lake temperature is about half a degree a decade over the last three decades. And as wind speeds fall, thermoclines are rising. And so these are potentially important changes in lakes. If we look at a survey of lakes in the area that were sampled in the 80s and then 20 to 25 years later, and you're going to see a few graphs like this where there's 80s data on the x-axis and more recent data 20 years later on the y-axis, most of the points are above the line, or more of the points are above the line. So there's been about a 1 degree warming in fall temperature in these lakes. Now, the data I didn't show is that, and we occasionally hit 28 degrees more often now in the summer than we used to. So when lakes hit 28 degrees in the summer, things start to happen. So there are many effects, potentially effects of warmer water. I've listed a few of them in the upper part, but I'm more interested in the things that might be a bit more surprising to you, like the indirect effects. So There's two indirect effects I'm mentioning here, and one that I'll illustrate. So lakes or biota become more sensitive to falling calcium in warmer water, and we actually lose essential long-chain fatty acids. Here's an example of that. So Jenny Fischino did her master's with me and Michael Arts, and this is from her work done in the lab at 20, 24, and 28 degrees on the lipid composition of green algae. And what you can see as the temperature rises is a dramatic reduction in ALA, the alpha-linolenic acid, that underpins the DHA and the EPA that's in our brains, that's in those omega-3 fatty acid tablets I hope everyone took this morning, 1 gram per day. And so as water is warm, there's a change in composition from diatoms to chrysophytes away from forms that make these essential omega-3 fatty acids. And algae very quickly change their lipid chemistry as water warms, to the detriment of everything that eats that algae. The water quality is actually changing in many ways, and I'm going to race through this. Same sort of plots. So this is regional change in water quality. So dissolved organic carbon levels have gone up in all lakes by about 25%. So that has all kinds of impacts. You know, shallower and warmer waters, less UV penetration, change in speciation of metals, more heterotrophic food chains. But perhaps most interesting, a change in cestodon chemistry. So I'm going to show you in a minute that phosphorus is falling, but carbon is rising, and that leads to higher C-to-P ratios, poorer quality food, you know, for things that eat the algae. And one that I'm just realizing is altered mate selection in fish. There's a brilliant professor at Queen's who came to our area, and he said, these lakes are now too brown, and the fish are going to have trouble finding mates. That I had no idea that that was another possibility. Phosphorus levels in our lakes have fallen. We all know the importance of phosphorus. Much of this happened between 75 and 95. We don't have many mesotrophic lakes anymore. They're now mainly oligotrophic, which is shocking, you know. This is probably happening because of the gradual acidification of watersheds, more binding of phosphorus, but there are other possible explanations as well. We all know that phosphorus is the limiting nutrient that controls phytoplankton productivity on the shield. So all of these things can happen, but because I'm talking about zooplankton, did you also know it probably means that animals get bigger, you know, when in the plankton when phosphorus levels fall? So here's the average body size of water fleas in our lakes over the last 25 years. So imagine you were driving down the road today and the average cow was now 10 feet long, not 6 feet long. You know, you would notice things like this. The average cladocerin is 60% longer now in our lakes than it was 25 years ago. That's an enormous change. Think if the average moose, instead of being 8 feet long, was 14 feet long. You know, that's the magnitude of change that's happened. I've been spending a lot of time in the last few years working on calcium decline. So 30 years ago, on average, all of our lakes had 2.5 to 3.5 milligrams per liter of calcium. There's one weird lake, Dickey, the one that's DE there, where the cottagers on the lake have all retired and moved to permanent homes. They don't like the dust on the gravel roads. Now the municipality adds calcium chloride, so we've now got an experimental lake because of cottagers becoming older and moving to the cottage. But in every other case, calcium levels are falling for a couple of reasons. Sometimes getting less now than 1.5 milligrams per liter. Very, very low levels. Here, for example, is I showed you the picture of Plastic Lake before. Here's what the calcium level in Plastic Lake has done. And 1.5 milligrams per liter is the level in the lab we've determined at which there's dramatic impacts on daphnia. and that's been a subject that Ionita worked on for her master's degree, and others have, I don't know if others have worked on that, but it's a very widespread phenomenon that's happening on the Shield Lakes that has implications that are for all crusty animals, for mollusks, for crayfish. You know, we're losing crayfish on the Southern Canadian Shield. even in lakes without bass. So this looks like a widespread phenomenon. And when changes happen, they can happen very quickly. So here's the abundance. We have 7 Daphnia species commonly on the shield. 2 of them, Daphnia cataba and Daphnia ambigua, have about half the calcium requirement of the other species. The other 5 all have a higher calcium requirement. And in 2004, when the average calcium level fell below 1.5 milligrams per liter, these 5 species just disappeared from our records. Happened very quickly and appears to be permanent. not all changes are bad. pH is absolutely rising in our study lakes. So here it is across the region. Historically, half the lakes had a pH Only half the lakes had a pH above 6. Now three-quarters of the lakes have a pH above 6. Very, very, with clear benefits for all biota. Another thing that happens as people move to our lakes is they want the roads maintained in the winter. So road salt is being added to lakes in our area. So Dickey and Harp are two most well-studied, or well-developed lakes, and sodium levels are rising because of road salt additions. Now, at the moment, in these lakes, those levels are not damaging. But if instead of a seasonal recreational road, a highway goes through the watershed, which is what's happened in a bunch of the lakes we monitor in Sudbury. So the Highway 17 bypass went through the watershed of Hannah and Middle Lake in 1973, the year we started monitoring these lakes. And since then, there's been a 100-fold increase in chloride, approaching levels, approaching Canadian water quality guidelines for chloride. I'm going to return to this because the question I then want to ask is, are there interactions of stressors? Is chloride more damaging when phosphorus levels are falling? And the answer to that question will be yes. And predators are arriving. I won't say much about predators because Tony is going to talk about this. Here's the spiny water flea, Bithotrephes. All of the drawings in the literature on the spiny water flea just are of the animal. They're drawn by biologists. I wanted a drawing done by somebody that would make a movie. So I actually worked with an artist in England. This is only the second time this painting has been shown. I sent him a bunch of Daphnia pictures and a bunch of Bithotrephes pictures, and he produced this painting of the spiny water flea descending on a bunch of Daphnia. Now, for those that are squeamish, the Daphnia I sent him are Daphnia mendoti, which has the best avoidance response to the spiny water flea, so no Daphnia died in the construction of this painting. But there is an enormous impact of the spiny water flea on richness. I'm going to use Stephanie Boudreau's old master's thesis work to illustrate this because nothing done since then has changed this story. She visited 15 uninvaded lakes, 15 invaded lakes, found 32 species of zooplankton. The rare ones found in less than a third, there was no pattern. But if you look at the 20 most common species in that bluish box, you'll see that 18 of them are found less often in the presence of the invader. There's a dramatic impact of this invader on biodiversity. So conditions are changing. Our lakes are less windy, which means they're warmer, which means they don't mix as deep, and they hold more heat later into the fall, which means they turn over later and they freeze later, right? These are big changes in the physics of our lakes. They're less acidic, a good thing. They're more oligotrophic. That's not good or bad. It's just because they were never that eutrophic to start with. They're more colored with higher levels of organic carbon. They're decalcifying, but they're getting saltier. So monovalent to divalent cation ratios are changing, which potentially is important for things like mollusks. The biota is changing. I didn't talk about bass, but bass is spreading around the region. Invaders like the spiny water flea is spreading around. Phytoplankton composition is changing. We're actually losing diatoms, gaining chrysophytes, which has impacts on biochemistry. And I believe all these things, if that wasn't complicated enough, these things interact. So I'll just show you three quick interactions. Aaron Brown is doing a master's in my lab trying to figure out the food sensitivity of chloride toxicity to Daphnia. Whenever we work with Daphnia in the lab doing toxicology work, we just want to get rid of the food effect, right? So everything is fed at saturation. So everything we do in Daphnia toxicology in the lab is potentially flawed because in nature, in 95% of Canada's lakes, the Daphnia are starving most of the time. In the lab, they produce 30 eggs per clutch. In the field, they produce 2 eggs per clutch or 1 egg per clutch. They're starving. So if there's an effect of starvation level on sensitivity to stressors, and there's a chance that our toxicological literature is flawed. So here's an example of that. In his first, this is still preliminary work done last fall, he looked at the LC50 for chloride on the y-axis versus how well fed the animals are. And remember that the chronic guideline for Canada is 120 milligrams per liter of chloride. As long as there was lots of food, 1 milligram carbon per liter, the LC50 was above that, but as we dropped food levels to something more typical of lakes on the shield, the LC50 was below the current water quality guideline. Here's another example of an interaction of stressors, the vulnerability of Daphnia to predators in the face of reduced calcium. So on the x-axis, this is work led by Howie Risen. Ionina was a co-author of this work. Done in my lab at Dorset. The question we were asking is, does low calcium induce changes in animals that prevents them from defending themselves against predators. So Daphne are defended against Chiabris in many ways, but this particular species uses that neck tooth that's shown on the photograph on the far right on the back of its head. First instar animals, the four bars called number one, are too small to be protected by neck teeth. Fourth instar animals, the four bars on the right-hand side, are too big to need, they're big enough that they don't need the neck teeth. But instar two and three animals need the neck teeth. That's half of their juvenile life stages. And you can see that the A's and the B's at calcium levels of less than 1.5 milligrams per liter, their neck teeth are not nearly as big. So we estimated that this was a 2- to 3-fold increase in the vulnerability of animals to their normal predators induced by low calcium. So there's interactions of stressors. And finally, this can play out at a regional level. This is more work from Michelle Palmer's PhD thesis. You know, zooplankton biodiversity is actually rising in our lakes because calcium hasn't fallen in enough lakes yet to kill a lot of things. As lakes recover from acidification and get warmer, but the presence of the spiny water flea reduces that beneficial trend. You have to look at physics, chemistry, and biology to really understand what's going on in these lakes. And we have some evidence of regime shifts. I don't know when to call something a regime shift, but I'm going to go out on a limb and call this a regime shift. When we're losing crusty animals and gaining gel-clad animals that have a 20th of the calcium and half the phosphorus, there's implications all across the whole food web and for the water users as things start to clog. So we're losing Daphnia that have 20 times the calcium demand of holopedium, twice the phosphorus demand of holopedium. They're more vulnerable to invertebrate predators than holopedium. So we're getting this shift from crusty Daphnia to these jelly-clad holopedium. Here's an example of that. Again, this is Michelle's work, but in a paper done in collaboration with John Small's lab, led by his postdoc, Anna Jazorski. If we look at holopedium abundances in the 80s, in 30-odd lakes in the area compared to now, you can again see most of the points are above the line, and the presence of bithotrephes actually makes that worse. So there's been an increase in a switch from these crusty Daphnia communities to these gel-clad animals. For those of you that have not dragged a net through the water with lots of holopedium, you'll know how frustrating it is. That's because these animals just are balls of jelly. It's called holopedium.
What is it?
Oh, it's another cladocerin. It's a zooplankton that's found in the water column, but it's the only one that uses as a defense a big ball of jelly. So if the animal I've said that often before. If I was the animal, the ball of jelly would be 50 times my volume. And so if the animal is a millimeter long, the ball of jelly might be a centimeter long. So you get your plankton nets get completely clogged. And there's one water filtration plant in Colorado now that's currently spending millions of dollars because their intakes are being clogged by this particular species. So in the oceans, we're going to jellyfish. In Canadian Shield Lakes and freshwater, we're going to gel-clad animals, but not jellyfish. So this is really what Tony asked of us. What might our children experience, in this case, on these lakes when they're adults? So lots of things are changing. So we have shorter winters, for sure. And where I work in Muskoka, a couple of hours north of Toronto, is an area where we probably will lose ice over the next several decades in the winter. So this continued warming can increase the eutrophication threat, even though phosphorus levels are falling. I actually believe it's possible that we'll lose biota in shallow lakes when they get too hot, because at around 28 degrees, 29 degrees, there's sharp thresholds when many of these creatures start to die, and it wouldn't take much of a hot spell for half of the lakes to hit 28 degrees, because most of the lakes are small and shallow. I think there's a reduction in food quality happening to feed food webs, because DOC C-to-P ratios, I think, are being changed by falling phosphorus and rising organic carbon. And the loss of diatoms and then replacement by chrysophytes is affecting the biochemical food quality. The entire southeastern Canadian Shield is decalcifying. I think that's enormously important. The levels of calcium in the lakes reflect the levels in the soil. Right now, in the Plastic Lake watershed, 80% of the usable calcium is actually in the trees. If that forest is logged, if it was clear-cut, it would not grow back. There isn't enough calcium in the soil to grow that forest back. And it would take about 150 years, we estimate, to replace that calcium by normal weathering processes. So poorer tree growth, I think, is possible, and lower lake water calcium, and that has implications for mollusks, for crayfish for crusty animals, and the switch to gel clad animals, which has implications for water drawers. More people are moving to Muskoka. That shows up in our in salt levels that I've shown you, but it probably also shows up in pharmaceuticals and other things that come through wastewater plants and probably more fishing pressure. And we'll hear more from Tony about invading species. So lots of things are changing, and these things interact, and I think they will surprise us. Just going to remind you of three surprises that I think we've seen in our data. So we saw this rapid loss of five species of Daphnia in Plastic Lake when the calcium hit 1.5 milligrams per liter. That's what that red arrow points at. And here's the time series of the abundance of the gel-clad animal Holopedium in our eight long-term study lakes. Three of them, the ones called CBDE and Plastic, Chub Dickey and Plastic, were already acidic and low calcium and had lots of Holopedium right when we started in the 1980s. But the other five, Blue Chalk, Crosshaw, Heart, Peony, Red Chalk, were only 3 to 4% Holopedium, except for Crosshaw, which had a really anomalous value in 1981, which is why that first data, dark data point is high. And then suddenly, in all five of these lakes, the abundance of Holopedium increased dramatically. So I think changes can be very, very rapid with animals that reproduce, you know, every 10 days. And then this isn't quite as rapid, but this was the loss of richness of zooplankton biodiversity, summer cladostrin biodiversity in Harp Lake associated with the arrival of the spiny water flea. So changes can happen quite rapidly. So are we prepared, you know, for this sort of rising complexity? So what I've shown is many changes in the physics and the chemistry and the ecology of our lakes, familiar stressors, acidity, phosphorus, but also probably associated with novel stressors, pharmaceuticals and road salt and invaders, and these things interact. We are, I think, approaching thresholds for some of them, and some of these changes may represent actual regime shifts in the way ecosystems are functioning. So I'm going to put on my other hat now, as Tony mentioned, and ask, as applied ecologists who have to work with real environmental issues, are we prepared to deal with these changes in Canada today? Now, we know we have real experience in solving environmental problems. I'm an optimist, generally, about environmental problems. It takes two sort of interactive activities. You know, we have to, first of all, detect problems. That's in the assessment loop on the left-hand side of these two connected circles here. So as applied ecologists, we track the status and trends of indicators with reference to targets that reflect when those indicators are in good shape, right? And we report that. So our first two jobs as applied scientists are problem detection and reporting to the public. If the public agrees with us that there is an issue, then we move into that right-hand loop, prevention and remediation, where we have three other clear jobs as environmental scientists. Diagnosis, to identify the actual stressor from or stressors from among all the possible stressors. Prognosis, to model cause-effect stressor response linkages to the extent that we can actually give some advice on what should be done. And then, hopefully, with the preferred solution being applied and with the passage of time, we can actually assess whether it worked. These are the things that applied scientists, these are the roles we play in environmental management. For relatively, there are others, but this is the simplest way, I think, to portray what we do. And we've followed this model with fabulous success many times and have made many really serious problems better. Here's a list of five where we've made really substantial improvements from really bad problems in the past. And a few of these, like lead pollution and DDT, were truly global scale problems, you know, that we've gone a long way towards solving. We haven't totally solved them, but we've gone a long way towards solving several of these. The lead levels in maple trees in Toronto are 1% of what they were 40 years ago. The lead levels in human blood are have gone from, in Canada, about 120, they've fallen fourfold. So when we reduced lead levels in the environments, it was beneficial for us. The levels of all kinds of pesticides in human breast milk are 1 to 2 orders of magnitude, 10 to 100 times less than they were in the 70s. You know, we can make enormous differences if we know what we're doing. So what do we actually have to do? You know, to have these successes, we have to, first of all, detect problems. So we have to compare actual environmental condition with targets that reflect our values, you know, that will indicate when things are in good or bad shape. We have to communicate that to see if the public agrees with us that we do or do not have problems. Because only an informed, in the words of Thomas Jefferson, you know, an informed public, only an informed public can be trusted with their government, is what Thomas Jefferson said. We must do diagnostic research. You know, we must distinguish actual from possible causes of problems. We must do prognostic research. So we must look at the cause-effect linkages cleverly enough that we can actually inform management decisions. Then we must actually do something. You know, we have to intervene, usually, and then see if it worked. You know, these are the jobs of applied scientists. My real worry in Canada right now is that we seem to be pulling back from many of these things that we've done in the past that seem to work so well to deal with our problems. So we're reducing our ability to detect problems by reducing the requirements for environmental assessment work. I heard the other day that there's only one lake now that the government's required to monitor in the far north, which is Baker Lake. We are insulating the public from communicating with scientists, which is dangerous. We're stopping some work, large-scale important work, on diagnosis and on the testing of trigger limits or compliance values that would protect the environment. And then we're reducing the federal workforce capable, I think, of modeling cause-effect linkages. And reducing the number of sites where interventions to eliminate the cause are required. So it used to be, under the with the Fisheries Act implementation, that essentially all water bodies were considered potential fisheries habitat and had to be protected, and we're not doing that anymore. So that's serious. So I have a very simple view of the environmental management process, and that is to solve environmental problems in a functioning democracy, and we won't talk about what a functioning democracy is very much, a little bit, that all we need is knowledge. We need to know what the problems are, what caused them, what to do about it, and the will to act. We need to have, it doesn't take money. It's never an issue of money. There's always enough money. It's really about knowledge and will. So I have a favorite Canadian poet whose name is Richard Outram. And he said this on CBC one day, and it stuck in my head, and I've never been able to get rid of this quote. The cardinal human values are humility and hope. Of course, humility underpins knowledge. You know, we have to be humble enough to know individually we're stupid, collectively we're pretty smart. We've often got it wrong. But let's learn from the number of times we got it wrong. There's many other people have expertise that we need. Our children, Aboriginal people, our elders, people in other disciplines. If the Japanese had listened to their archaeologists, they would have known that this catastrophe was coming, but they were just listening to the geologists, not the archaeologists. and there are other sources of will other than hope, but without hope, there won't be any will to act. So I looked for another poet that could fill in the right side of this, couldn't find one, so I was forced to make up this. So this is Norman's, if on the left we have the cardinal human values, then these are the cardinal human flaws. Arrogance and despair. So arrogance, of course, only the arrogant have closed minds, and if you have a closed mind, that's certainly an impediment to knowledge. And despair is no platform from which to do anything. So in Canada and in Western democracies, we tend to talk about left and right as if these were the only two gradients in governments that mattered. We've had fabulous governments on the left and fabulous governments on the right. In terms of environmental protection, that's not the gradient that really matters. The gradient that I believe really matters is the authoritarian gradient, because, of course, there have been horrible governments on the left, like communism, and horrible governments on the right, like fascism, that have not done good thing for children's health and environmental condition. So I discovered this book a few years ago by Seymour Gart, and in this book I discovered this freedomhouse.org database, which is the status of freedom and democracy in the world's countries. And Seymour Gart used this to show that how free a country is, Canada is a 7 on this graph, is a good predictor of infant mortality. It makes perfect sense when you think about it, because if your government is doing things that kill your children and it's a democracy, you're going to boot the buggers out. And so it occurred to me that there should also be a relationship between freedom and environmental condition. So the Yale Center for Environmental Law and Policy produces, along with three collaborators, this amazing data set every couple of years on environmental performance using 11 different indicators. Canada is currently 58 on this scale. 100 is good, you know, 0 is bad. And so I spent a Sunday afternoon with my wife at the dining room table merging these two databases, of the Freedom of Nations and environmental performance. And if you go to the Freedom House database these days, the simplest metrics they provide is they divide all the countries of the world into three categories: free, partially free, and not free. And for the statisticians in the audience, the p-value for this ANOVA was 10 to the minus 11. There is a very, very strong relationship between how free countries are and the performance of their environment. And the big change happens not between what they call free and not free, but what they call free and partially free. So relatively modest losses in freedom end up apparently being associated with dramatic reductions in environmental condition in nations. Now, here's the really good news. The really good news is that this is all data from Freedom House that anyone can access. There's a lot more free countries in the world today than there was in the 70s. So there's been a dramatic, actually, loss of completely not free countries. Think back to the collapse of the Eastern Bloc countries. So we haven't lost. There's been almost half the countries in the world are now free. So that's both good and bad. You know, it depends if you're a cup half full or a cup half empty person. But whatever it is, it does represent a dramatic improvement in democracy in the world, and that should translate and has translated in Russia into dramatic benefits for environmental condition. So in conclusion, how's my time, Tony? I'm doing okay. My initial job was to perhaps point out how complicated things are in terms of changes that are happening, that the physics, chemistry, and ecology of lakes in, I won't say in the north, but at least in the near north, halfway to the North Pole, remote lakes, but that are downstream of dominant weather trajectories in North America, is changing sometimes quite rapidly, and I think several of these things will continue. Some of these changes are very good, you know, rising pH in response to reduction in acid deposition, but others are neither maybe good nor bad, phosphorus changing, but others are probably clearly bad, like the arrival of invading species, increased road salt, declining calcium levels. Those things are probably bad. We actually know how to solve these sorts of problems. We know what sort of research is needed. We know what sort of public engagement is needed to solve these kinds of problems. We have many examples where we've solved problems of this scale in the past. It's not a matter of money. It is a matter of money allocation, for sure, but we have the money. We can fight the war in Iraq. We can solve climate change. You know, those are the kinds of decisions we have to make as democratic nations. But we are actually less able to act on our understanding of how to fix these problems now than in the past, because we're not informing the public as well. We're not gathering the data needed to track status and trends that will inform us that we have developing problems when we can solve them at an earlier stage. We're doing less of that sort of work. And it's very, very important that that sort of knowledge, both scientific knowledge and transfer of that knowledge to the public, is protected, and that will to act is nurtured if our environment is to be protected. Talks like this, it's hard to find acknowledgments, so I used Wordle and typed in the last names of my 175 co-authors. And so here's the people I owe this most to. You'll see Bill Keller, Don McQueen, Peter Dillon. There's two Pattersons there. That's why Patterson gets such a big last name. And little Michelle Palmer over on the right-hand side above the Girard, who contributed a lot to this talk. Here's Michelle in her favorite place out on the water. And I'll also acknowledge my funders and Tony for the invitation. Thank you very much. Okay.